Hello, my name is Michelle Yana-Chan, the Wandering Book Collector, and this is my podcast, Conversations with Writers Exploring What's Informed Their Books and Their Lives Around Themes of Movement, Memory, Sense of Place, Borders, Identity, Belonging, and Home. The Wandering Book Collector podcast is supported by Abercrombie and Kent. I'm joined by the writer Justin Morozzi to discuss his book, Islamic Empires, 15 Cities That Define a Civilization. It opens in Mecca in the 7th century, moving to Damascus, Baghdad, Cordoba, Jerusalem, Cairo, Fez, Samarkand, Constantinople, Kabul, Isfahan, Tripoli, Beirut, and ending in modern times with Dubai and Doha. Justin's previous books include Baghdad, City of Peace, City of Blood, also The Man Who Invented History on Herodotus, and Tamerlane on the awesome warrior and conqueror, plus south from Barbary, following the slave routes that crossed the Libyan Sahara. Justin, welcome to the Wandering Book Collector.
Thanks very much, Michelle. Lovely to be with you.
The starting point of your latest book, Justin, is that once upon a time, Islamic civilization was the envy of the world, forward-looking, forward-thinking, in which nothing was off-limits. Given that, I wanted to ask you how it felt writing this book. Emotionally?
Yes, I think one of the reasons I think I wanted to write it, in one way, it was a sort of distillation of places I've lived in or visited many times over the years, or there's a strong family connection. But the other one was almost a bit more journalistic, trying to push back against that tide of doom and gloom, which was really, I think still is actually, just dominating coverage of what is often called, you know, the Middle East, North Africa, the Arab world, where, you know, especially in the decade since 2011 and the largely ill-fated Arab Spring, the stories coming out of the region have understandably been incredibly grim and full of tragedy and bloodshed. And I just thought, you know, with a historian's hat on, why don't we revisit some of the cities that we're hearing about in the news today in an entirely different context, when they were resplendent around the world, cultural leaders, intellectual innovators, and so on and so forth. And I don't think I was looking for anything especially didactic, but as the book progressed, I did think, started to think, you know, is there a pattern here? What is it that makes these cities successful at their high points? And when it does go wrong, are there things we can read into those cities and explain how you go from sort of, you know, cultural greatness to apocalyptic slaughter in places like Baghdad was one of the obvious ones, for example. So yeah, it's a bit of an attempt to move away from the current and revisit some of the glories of the past and try to understand how you go from one to the other.
And so how does that feel? Does that feel hauntingly sad, nostalgic, or more neutral?
I think they evoke very different reactions. For example, if, you know, going around Dubai, we're kind of heading from history into sort of modern journalism, really. And Doha, which is where I end the book, is very much a present tense bit of reporting almost. But some of the cities, yes, there's great, terrible feeling of tragedy. One of my favorite cities was Tripoli, which I think in some ways wouldn't necessarily justify its position in the book were it not for the sort of personal connection I've had with that place since I was a teenager. And to go from that in, you know, the 80s and 90s, the time of Gaddafi and a pretty strict, highly regulated dictatorship, to the euphoria of the 2011 revolution, which I also covered as a journalist, and then revisiting it when the city, Tripoli, and the entire country, Libya, are tearing themselves apart was tremendously distressing. I mean, it's all very well for me to say that as a Westerner and as a Brit, but for Libyans, you can imagine it's completely devastating. So I think different cities have evoked different responses. Baghdad, probably I saw some of the worst times in recent years when I lived there from 2004. Things have got rather better, I think, since then, but they've also had to go through that terrible time of ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, and indiscriminate slaughter on the streets and across the country. So you know, Constantinople, Istanbul, one of my favorite cities in the world. And that's often I get asked that, you know, what's your favorite city? And I say almost every single one in the book. I adore these cities, really, with the exception of Mecca, which obviously I'm not allowed to visit unless I either do something very naughty and go undercover, like Richard Burton did in the 19th century, which I don't think would be a great idea, or become Muslim, which has yet to happen.
And that said, you account for many of these cities across the centuries, how rivers ran red with blood and corpses rotted in the streets. And this is when these cities were enjoying their golden age. So is it ever thus?
They do have quite different history. I mean, Beirut, I suppose, that was an interesting city as well, actually, because Beirut, you could say, with a kind of modern lens on all our talk of diversity and inclusivity, Beirut at one level, incredibly diverse, 18 different sects, all with sort of, you know, designated positions under the constitution and so on. So its simultaneous strength is also its terrible weakness as well, though, because as we see now, you know, the breakdown, the antagonisms between occasionally antagonistic communities can rip a city apart as well. When you talked about, you know, rivers running red with blood and black with ink, that is specifically Baghdad, and that was when Hulagu, the grandson of Genghis Khan, came in and just led this sort of completely savage conquest of the city and destroyed libraries, the mosques, the madrasas, the religious colleges, and really a civilization that had been there for a good 500 years as the world's leading sort of intellectual center. But I think if you look at that particular city, Baghdad, what really interested me was that recurrent pattern of violence. In a very sort of crude and cynical shorthand, you could say it's this sort of Sunni Islam versus Shia Islam. And it's more complicated than that, but that is one of the fundamental aspects to it. And yet it also has these moments of just completely peerless ascendancy, not just in the Islamic world, but worldwide. And I started, I suppose, thinking or suggesting to myself that maybe this was because at that time it's very open, it's very tolerant, great relations between the different religions, the Jews, the Muslims, Christians, fewer antagonisms between Sunni and Shia Muslims. It's almost like a recipe for success. And then when those things start going wrong, basically all hell breaks loose. One of the most surprising things I thought about Baghdad, or a statistic, was in 1917, I think something like 40% of the population of Baghdad was Jewish. And then when I arrived in 2004, so a good deal less than a century later, I think there were 7 Jews left in the city, in one of the oldest Jewish communities on the planet, completely hounded into extinction. And I would make a direct link between that sort of chauvinism and lack of tolerance to these cities when they're at their lowest ebbs. You look in vain for sort of tolerance between the faiths and so on.
Well, I think about the end of the book with respect to that, jumping forward to Doha, leaping onto the world stage, as you put it. And it's not all going their way, of course, right now. One of your interview partners there was a Qatari engineer who was sharing his worries about being a minority in his own city. He called it dangerous, in fact. So I'm not sure that perspective works for a city to become great. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's really interesting, Michelle. And in your introduction, you said, you know, one of the themes you look at is belonging. And I think nowhere other than in Dubai and Doha did I pick up on anything, any sort of sense of uncertainty about that. You know, if you come from Tripoli, you're a Tripoline or Tripolitan. If you come from Baghdad, you're a Baghdadi. It's very clear that's part of your identity. But I think in those two cities, which uniquely the sort of indigenous city inhabitants are a small minority and becoming a smaller minority all the time as they develop and bring in foreign workers from around the world. That sense of not belonging or identity really nagging. And I found it probably a bit more acute in Doha, where I suspect because it's a newer city, as a city rather than a pearl fishing village. it's newer than Dubai, which had had more decades of development. And it may be that Emiratis are a bit more comfortable at the moment with that whole aspect of being a small minority in their own sort of city state. But it, it's fascinating as well, though, because a lot of them are, you know, understandably very proud of those two cities and the extraordinary development. The Maktoum family had this sort of mantra, you know, build it and they will come. And they wanted to make the word Dubai familiar on the lips of men and women around the world. And they were laughed at the time. And now I think, you know, you could safely say that Dubai is known worldwide. And I think there's a similar aspiration in Doha. As to whether they can become great cities, I think that's a, yeah, I'm not saying that they would necessarily become great cities. I suppose Doha interested me almost as a sort of a laboratory case for how to build a modern city. Is it an Arab city? Is it a global city? What is its kind of essence and its culture? And I think that that's all being not thought out on the streets, but it's being sort of defined by burgeoning population with plenty of different cultures. And Qatar, as you say, back in the news at the moment with the World Cup.
I mean, they're undoubtedly fascinating cities, especially for a journalist to see the spectacular urban transformations and almost limitless resources driving their ambitions. But I personally don't feel much affection or joy there. And I know you slightly moan about people like me, the Dubai and Doha bashers in your book, but you didn't give much away, Justin, for how you feel about these cities. What do you think?
Well, I would say that Dubai's never been one of my favorite cities, I suppose because I'm a bit more old fashioned and I love somewhere like Baghdad, where you can almost literally stand on a street and dig down and find history buried beneath the soil that on which you stand. And it's obviously it's harder to find that in Dubai and Doha. Are they my favorite cities? No, I don't think they are. If you really push me and say, give me, of the 15, just choose one. I'd struggle viciously and I'd say, please don't make me choose. But if I really had to, it would be Istanbul, which I adore Istanbul. But I think what I wanted to say about those Dubai and Doha, though, is I think it was important to kind of address, I'm not saying you're one of these people who carps or sneers at Dubai, but there are people who do. And I had a nice quote from, I think she was a sociologist in Dubai, and she said, you know, the Sudanese, the Iraqis, the Lebanese, the Libyans, the Tunisians, the Algerians, the Moroccans, you name it, they'll all sneer at Dubai and say, you know, you're so crude, you're so vulgar, you've got no history, but they all want to come and live here.
I know, but Justin, I mean, you know, Iraq or Dubai, you know, Sudan or Dubai, I mean, it's all relative.
Yeah, it's all relative.
The world is envying Dubai and Doha like they were envying Islamic civilizations over the last millennia.
Yeah, I suppose the a lot of those countries we just mentioned, you know, have been involved in pretty destructive conflicts and civil wars and revolutions. And so it's understandable that, you know, if you are feeling that, you know, your future in either Baghdad or Cairo under the Sisi regime, which is pretty brutal, and you felt you didn't have much future there, then Dubai might simply make sense. Just on the grounds that people aren't killing themselves in their droves, or the levels of freedom are so much higher.
Quite a low bar.
Pretty low bar. But I think that's one of the tragedies of the region at the moment, you know, being realistic. How many of these cities are in countries that you know, many of us would want to go in and live in forever? I mean, my father was born in Beirut. It was part of my childhood in the background. You know, his sort of wistful longing for a city that he didn't know particularly well, but was being destroyed in the 1975 to 1990 civil war. Would either of us want to go and live in Beirut now? I think not really. I mean, difficult enough being a journalist there, but actually living there as a Beiruti, it's unimaginably awful and sad. And I think around the region, that desperate Damascus, one of the great, great, great storied cities of the world, one of the great Arab centers of civilization, who wants to go and live there under the Assad regime now? It's desperate.
I got it wrong when I had to guess. I told myself, guess which one is your favorite city. And I got it wrong because I thought it was Cairo. When I read this book, yes. It is, you know, there was a quote. The quote I love, which I'm going to plagiarize at some point, is, there is nowhere better to find your bearings in space and time. I totally get that. And I love that. That's why I thought Cairo was your choice.
The layers of history, just one upon another and another, it just goes on and on. And that's why I sort of feel conflicted about saying, you know, one of them is my favorite cities. I love all of these cities, almost without exception.
And you called a few of them home before. And I know you've just run through this a little bit, but do you want to call any of them home again?
I always have this vision of just spending, you know, living there again, rather than sort of just dropping in. But I would definitely feel the same about Istanbul. I think Beirut just seems to be very sadly off the agenda. I would have loved to be based out there for some time. Kabul, I've always loved as well. I mean, I'm just sort of blown away by its sort of physical aspect and environment on first sight. The city surrounded by mountains. And the chapter I wrote on Kabul in the 16th century was deliberately chosen to give a sort of a way into Babur, who, although he wasn't an Afghan, he was actually born in what is now Uzbekistan in the Fergana Valley, came to adore the city of Kabul, which probably for many of us today would, you know, you think, what the hell? It's a war zone. It's Taliban. It's ISIS, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a very beautiful you know, urban setting. Maybe the city itself has seen better days, and that's God knows how many decades now we're looking at the fighting has dragged on. But it's a very beautiful place in a spectacularly beautiful country. So Kabul, I always feel, is you know, opportunity to go back and spend much more time there. But what about Samarkand as well? We haven't even mentioned the word Samarkand, which is one of the great ancient cities as well. I know you were talking with Anthony Satin recently, and Tamerlane came up. And that's a sort of idea where the nomad meets the settled. Tamerlane, one of the great nomads, but he also made a point of building one of the greatest capital cities on earth, Samarkand, in the 14th century.
Well, to quote Timur or Tamerlane, as you do in the book, he said, "Let he who doubt our power look upon our buildings." And even for a nomad like him, he understood that legacy often comes through the building of cities. Yet I wanted to challenge you on that. You know, you've chosen the structure of looking at Islamic civilization through 15 cities. But is there something also missing, because that's the optics?
Well, something missing from the history, you mean, or
I guess the expanse of, you know, what else was going on in those Islamic civilizations. Because so much was movement as well, and nomadism, and the breadth of the globe. And Tamerlane is a good example, because although he, you know, Samarkand is always associated with him, he was also on the move a lot.
Yeah, and utterly restless. Campaigning, I think, virtually every year. I think with a two-year break from about 1370 to his death in, was it 1405, he only stopped for 2 years. And that was really just sort of throw himself into this sort of frenetic building spree in Samarkand, where he was just sort of chiding on the builders and whipping them and killing them if they didn't build things quickly enough. But as you say, otherwise, yeah, utterly nomadic as well. But is it, yeah, of course, you're right that it's limiting. I suppose I tried to increase the sway or the reach in terms of timeline. So giving it sort of the full 15 centuries from the very first Islamic century of the 7th century, you know, and the Prophet Muhammad, the birth of the new faith in the Arabian Peninsula, and then ending in our own time, just to look at one particular case. But yeah, you're right. It's limiting in the sense that the cities only tell part of the story. And it's limiting as well in a way that you could have a completely different list of 15 cities. I mean, some of them, I think, I felt personally, because I think, A, because I'd been there, but also B, because they were so important in the Islamic the early centuries of Islam, especially places like, you know, Mecca, Damascus, Baghdad, it would be a bit odd not to have those three, for example. But, you know, the 21st century, I could have chosen Bradford maybe as an example of a sort of contemporary Muslim urban setting. Maybe that would have been more controversial. It would have been very different as well. But lots of people occasionally say, you know, why didn't you mention Lahore? Or, you know, why didn't you mention Jakarta? And, you know, it's you can have that sort of debate endlessly. But as the writer, I suppose you eventually have to sort of focus on something. And I thought it was a pretty nice list of 50. So they're very different as well. You know, we can tell from the conversation we're having already that the variety for, you know, Samarkand, Kabul, Dubai, Mecca. Mecca, I thought, was a very interesting one. And it's hard to like a city that you can't get to know, if that makes sense. And I wondered whether, you know, is there an innate chauvinism to the outside world on behalf of Mecca? There aren't many cities on the planet that are completely closed to people who don't share that particular faith, for example. You know, I can walk into a mosque in most Islamic countries as a respectful visitor and admire its beauty, architecture, and so on and so forth. I can't even get into the city of Mecca. And I found that fascinating. What did it mean culturally? And coming across very old quotations about the harvesting of pilgrims. The pilgrims are there to be milked, you know, over 1,000 years ago. And I'm speaking to you today from a little village in Norfolk, which has had pilgrims for over 1,000 years. I wouldn't say the village milks the pilgrims particularly, but pilgrims are, you know, a part of the village life, and pilgrims are also a huge part of Meccan life. But it's not a city that it welcomes the Islamic world, but it only welcomes the Islamic world. And I found that it's kind of one of the more, well, I think it's the exceptional city in this list of 15 here.
You almost could have had a guest writer on that one, maybe.
Well, there are plenty of people. You could have the writer Ziauddin Saada, who wrote a recent biography of the city. That would be interesting. And you know, people who get very emotional about it, and Mecca being something that is kind of in their heart for decades until they can finally afford to make it, and will have a completely different relationship with that city. Yeah,
I can see very much how there must be people who feel like you left out their city or a particular city. But you also had a publisher probably on your back saying, we're not going to do 47 cities, Justin. Keep a lid on it.
I did toy one with sort of the idea of sort of a follow-up and some completely different cities. And I thought, no, I've done Baghdad several years ago. That took several years. This took several years. That's quite enough for now. Thanks very much.
Was your choice of subject for the book, or more accurately, the structure, in part because you wanted to go traveling to 15 phenomenally interesting cities, or 14, because obviously you couldn't go to Mecca?
Oh, I think definitely, yeah. I mean, I thought in one or two of the reviews, people have said this is actually as much a sort of travel itinerary as it is a history book. And I like that. I hadn't particularly thought of that. But yes, definitely. I mean, I've been quite, in a way, quite selfish. I suppose I just had to try to have, you know, test, you know, can this particular city hold its place in the book as at least a sort of vaguely significant part of the history of the Muslim world? And I thought, with the exception possibly of Tripoli, I think the answer is yes. But even with Tripoli, it's a great story that the 18th century, when a sort of an upstart dynasty just says to the Ottomans, well, we're not gonna carry on paying tribute to you. We're gonna run basically a pirate and corsairing racket and slave trading racket from this city, and you can all go to hell. We're taking over. Quite a bold move on behalf of a small little dynasty. And for about 130 odd years, they were able to successfully shake off their Ottoman overlord. So I just thought it was a really interesting city at that time. And I've been going there for over 30 years, and I just wanted to write about Tripoli. I do love it. It's almost a town rather than a city, but it's, I wrote my first book on about a camel journey, which, you know, started in Tripoli on the North African coast. All sorts of travel here, for sure. But having said that, a lot of people would say to me, you're kidding. I had no interest in going to Kabul. I've got no interest in going to Baghdad. You know, why are you Damascus now blowing itself to pieces? in the Civil War. Couldn't you have chosen some nicer cities? So you can't, sometimes you can't win.
I mean, you're a historian by trade, Justin, which makes me picture you in fusty libraries and fairs and bookshops in Cairo. But perhaps this, for this book, you were mostly on the street. How do you apportion time when researching a book like this? Do you long to be on the road or hold up reading or reading on the road?
Yeah, I definitely want to be on the street. And I think, I missed that opportunity in Mecca, obviously. But I think it's interesting because, you know, if you talk to the, and live among as much as possible, the people from these cities, you're going to learn so much more than basing your research only on the sort of the dusty books and dusty libraries thing. But I think try to do as much as possible of both. And I think in a way, one of my guides to all of this is someone like Herodotus, or even Ibn Battuta, who I know you touched on recently with Tim McIntosh-Smith, who's a writer I really admire. That kind of on the road traveling historian, diarist, memoirist. And Herodotus would, you know, traveled around looking for what he called great and marvelous deeds. And that could be the sex lives of Egyptian women, or how to mummify a corpse, flora and fauna, adventures, gossip, rumor, scandal. You know, he was a bit of an investigative reporter. He was a tabloid journalist. He was a dramatist. I like that kind of on the road approach to history as well, rather than only basing it on, the sort of the library thing. I think both can be limiting, but, you know, let's try to marry the two together and get a more rounded picture of, in this case, the cities and the people who come from them. And what do they think about their own cities and their history? You know, these are often very contested narratives, different interpretations, pride, hubris, shame, humiliation, all of the human emotions that we love. And we're all storytellers, aren't we?
Your own travels, Justin, have taken you from Mogadishu, where you were communications advisor for the Somali government, by the way, to being a foreign correspondent in Manila, to working for a security firm in Baghdad. Is there nothing this man can't do? Is it this, the geography and this diversity, the kind of cocktail life that drives you?
Gosh. I suppose my father was quite nomadic in a way. It's difficult to sort of pin things down when you're a child, and you know, whatever you have around you is normal. But I think my father had been something like 150 odd countries. He was working as an exporter and lived out of a Globetrotter suitcase, and spent a lot of his travels in the Middle East and in the Eastern Mediterranean, North Africa. So I suppose I kind of inherited that interest in that part of the world, but just had zero aptitude or interest really in business. So I kind of inherited his love of similar parts of the world, but with a historian's hat on rather than a sort of entrepreneurial exporter's hat on. So that's always felt quite normal. But I guess also thinking of this before we started speaking today is that how a lot of travel writers, their travel writing can be more limited to their early years. I'm just thinking of someone like Willie Dalrymple, a travel writer who moved much more towards history, and discussing that with him once. And he said, you know, well, you know, you acquire families, and perhaps it's more of a rarity to stay travel writing from your, you know, your first writings through to middle age and old age. It's a difficult thing. But at the same time, I think travel writing is it'd be strange for it to go out of fashion completely when we are such a sort of, as a species, we do travel a lot, and we love telling stories, whether, you know, Herodotus in his time, Colin Thubron, 2,500 years later, you know, in his 80s, still writing travel, trying to understand the world and come back and tell the stories about it. It's not just traveling, is it? It's traveling, recording, documenting, probably interviewing, researching, and coming back to tell a story.
Yeah, on a mission. I mean, I feel like if I'm traveling and I'm not documenting something or writing about it, I feel like I didn't really go now.
Yeah, if you haven't got your laptop out or your pen and moleskin notebook or something, there's something missing in there. You feel, you should be doing something.
I mean, given you chose kind of urban centres for this book, what's your own personal relationship with cities? And I ask you this now because I know you're in Norfolk and you've just returned from the wilds of Scotland where you were disconnected at least for a while, I know. So are you a city man yourself, or are you longing to tramp off among wet heather?
Yeah, the funny thing is, actually, in some ways I can't stand cities. I'm much happier with the wide open horizon. Here in Norfolk, it's huge skies, big seascapes, salt marshes, and few kind of mountains. But equally, the desert, somewhere in the Sahara, or in rural Afghanistan, I find that sort of topography or environment much more. It makes me much happier than being in a city. Having said that, I suppose foreign cities where I don't know so well, I think that there's that excitement of the new always. You know, I think, I don't know if it was at Freya Stark who said that there's nothing more exciting than waking up in an unknown city alone. Because it's incredibly exciting. You've got everything outside your hotel room or wherever you are is new and there to be discovered. So I think that can be completely exhilarating. But I've probably got to go to London tomorrow. Am I excited? No, I'll be really excited to return to the countryside, which I think I just find it better for the soul than, you know, a frantic urban existence, unless it's for sort of exploring and writing and researching and interviewing people and things.
In the opener to this section, Justin, Cairo of the 12th century, you quote Maimonides from The Guide for the Perplexed, best title ever. And this is the quote: "In times gone by, when storms and tempests threatened us, we wandered from place to place. But by the mercy of the Almighty, we have now been able to find a resting place in this city." In your research, as you traveled around all these countries and cities, did you ever feel like you could locate what it was that drew people to stop, to make a place home, and thereafter call it home?
God, that's an excellent question. It's so hard to generalize about a particular place. I mean, Dubai was on a creek. It was a sort of fishing village. Ostensibly, it didn't look like a great place to find a city. Baghdad, Mansour had been supposedly sailing up and down the Tigris looking for an auspicious place to found his new capital. So there are kind of different sort of foundation stories for some of these cities, but yes, I mean, there's some unique stroke of genius or favorable climate or proximity to a river or something that these cities share. And Maimonides was a really, really interesting case you mentioned. I mean, he was a Jewish scholar fleeing persecution and came to a largely Muslim city. Hard probably to find a 21st century equivalent of that, a Jewish scholar fleeing persecution coming to, look at the list, Isfahan, Kabul, Mecca, Baghdad. It's just not going to happen. So I think for him, it was a refuge, a tolerant place to continue his work, his writings, his research. And Baghdad in its heyday, the world, you know, flocked to it to make their fortunes, especially, you know, get rich, building construction boom, find jobs. I suppose I've always been, you know, with proximity to London, I've always felt that is a different type of, there's a similarity, you know, the world coming to London and migration to a city that can absorb and employ people from across the world. It is tremendously exciting, even though I'm a bit of a sort of country boy.
I mean, and put simply, when you speak about it that way, Maimonides might be just referring to somewhere that's welcoming.
Yes, absolutely. And I suppose, you know, these places can be more or less welcoming as well, you know, the different approaches to the outsider. I mean, I think to generalize massively, I've always found the Islamic world incredibly welcoming and hospitable. And I remember being in places like Libya when the US was bombing, I think it was Sudan at the time, and there was just kind of embarrassment with my Libyan host, but there was no sense, because I came from, you know, the UK, an ally of the US, that there should be any hostility towards me. Or it's always, you know, the most poor families share breaking bread with you and giving what they can, in a way that we in the West, I think, have completely forgotten. I mean, Wilfred Thesiger wrote about that in Arabian Sands, you know, that he hoped Arabs coming to the UK would realize that we're just as inhospitable to each other as we appear to be to them, by contrast with their incredible generosity when you know you visit their homes and their cities.
Jerusalem is the complicated city which so many believe to be their home or a home, but such a complicated home. Of the people you met there and interviewed and got to know, is it history then that makes a home or something else?
God, Jerusalem is such, you said it's complicated. And I think the word I used a lot about that one is contested as well. I mean, whose home is it? Is it one people's home? Is it the home of people who from only one faith rather than all three? Why has coexistence proved so difficult and blood-soaked between Jews, Christians, and Muslims? You know, why do certain people at different times think that it should be theirs exclusively? And people who have been kicked out of Jerusalem, who would still regard it as their home many, many, many years later. I think, as someone who is not especially religious at all, it's the one city that I thought, God, this, if there's any place on earth that has too much religion, it's Jerusalem. But then one could equally say it's the people who make the religion rather than the faith itself. So it's Muslims, Jews, and Christians behaving like humans, which is, you know, we love a fight, we're antagonistic, we like to think that our ways of doing things are better than other people's ways of doing things. And it all sort of coalesces into this sort of boiling atmosphere of tension. So for a kind of student of cities, I think it's hard to beat Jerusalem for all of these, this maelstrom of conflicting opinion, interpretation, different histories. I mean, there's no history of Jerusalem. They're histories plural. And they, like the people they represent, are highly contested as well and fought over. Even the archaeology there is incredibly political. I mean, it's completely fascinating. It's also somewhere I would never want to live either, for pretty much all of these reasons. I think there's too much conflict there. There's too much obsession with faith, and there's too much obsession with exclusivity. It's a very difficult place to, I think humans have shown that it's a very difficult place to coexist happily, peacefully, and with tolerance there.
And for you, Justin, do you feel different senses of belonging in different places? Perhaps not Jerusalem, but other cities that you've spent time and lived, now the countryside of Norfolk. But is there an attachment that goes beyond?
I think, sadly and strangely, maybe, I think in recent years, I almost felt like more of an outsider, possibly, because when you're in some of these places and you're from a part of the world, so here, you know, I'm British, I come from the UK, we've had our fair share of, say, you could say political turbulence recently. But to be honest, it's not really on the same scale at all as the sort of conflict and fighting in places like Baghdad and Damascus. So I think in some ways I felt more of an outsider there, and almost embarrassed to have come from a sort of a more prosperous, by complete accident of birth. These people are in cities that are really just tearing themselves apart in what can, I think that even the UN described it as Damascus as hell on earth. You know, it's one of the for traditional medieval Arab geographers, they call it a perfumed paradise. And that same city is now described as a hell on earth. And so I think I've probably felt less belonging and more awkwardness in visiting some of these cities, no matter how many times or how many years I sort of go back there. I've always felt I belonged a bit in Tripoli, but you know, who am I kidding? I'm not Libyan. I just have great fondness for the city and lots of really great friends there. But I'm never going to be a Libyan. I'm never going to be from Tripoli.
Well, Justin, finally, I wanted to turn to your own work and ask you what's next, what you're working on.
I am almost through the first draft of a history of slavery in the Muslim world, which is, I feel that every book I sort of bite off more than I can chew. Baghdad was desperately difficult. And then I went from one city to 15, and now I'm going to slavery in a book which I hope will barely mention the word Atlantic. It's nothing to do with the Atlantic slave trade. It's about the history of slavery in the Muslim world, which is completely fascinating.
And has that taken you on the road again?
A little bit, actually. To one of the most harrowing, I think, interviews I've ever done was with a recently liberated slave in Mali, who I think was one of the most distraught individuals I've ever spoken to, you know, with a notepad. It was pretty awful. A man who I think had reached the bottom of his life, really. What he'd managed to do was escape from slavery with his two wives and 12 children. His life was effectively over, but what he had achieved was to get his children out of that system of hereditary slavery. And I think that was the only positive in that encounter. So I have been a little bit on the road, yeah.
Harrowing stuff. Well, Justin, I look forward to learning more about that myself. And thank you, Justin Morozzi, for joining me on The Wandering Book Collector.
Thank you very much, Michelle. A huge pleasure.
And my thanks to the supporter of this podcast, Abercrombie & Kent. Goodbye.